We're here to make a dent in the universe, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. Hello, good morning, good evening, good day, and thank you for joining me for another episode of my podcast. And today, I'm tackling a subject that I have to confess intimidates me and I know very little about. I mean, this is my art. I created it thanks to IKEA and I consider that art, but we're going to find out exactly what constitutes art today with Mary Jane Morris, or Jane as she is known. Jane went to art school and later studied journalism. She's been covering art and the international art world her entire career. And interestingly, she's in the process of setting up an art intelligence business, which brings together media and data, which is quite in the early stages, and we'll touch on that today. So without further ado, let's welcome Jane.
Hi, Nicole. It's great to be here.
It's lovely to have you here too. And thank you so much. I know it's been difficult for you to schedule time in because of the Frieze Art Fairs. So tell us about these fairs that have occurred all over Europe, really, haven't they? And really what the purpose of these art fairs is.
Yeah, I think I should just say, just as sort of background for everyone listening and watching, the art world very much revolves around in-person events, whether that's art fairs, which are commercial events. That's where groups of galleries take space and show their roster of artists to collectors and the public, or biennales, which is non-commercial events, usually with a sort of lead curator, and they put on a show of what they think is current trends in the art world, plus museums and gallery shows. Now, for us in the international art world, the biennales and the art fairs are really important. It's where we see sort of current ideas in our world. And then, of course, museum shows also. So the art fairs and the biennales have basically, with a very few exceptions, been on hold now for the best part of almost two years, a year and a half. So what's happened is that as there has been some unlocking around the world, a whole heap of events have been shoved into September, October, November. So things that would normally have happened in the spring or the summer, it's all happening now. So if you were wanted to and you were brave enough and could cope with the vaccinations and travel restrictions, you could literally jump on a plane and be going from one big thing to another at the moment. For those of us based in London, Frieze Art Fair opened last week. This week it's FIAC in Paris, and on it goes.
So you say that the art world needs these in-person events. What has the impact been on the art industry, given that there have been no in-person events?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so we'll say, we'll talk now about the art market, let's say, because I think the non-commercial art world has some related but different challenges. So 2020 was a really hard year, I think, for most people in the commercial art world. And by that, I mean artists who have to make a living, commercial galleries who show and sell their work, and the auction houses. There was a period, I think, probably about the middle of last year, so yeah, the summer, where it looked like sales were down by half. And I think very few businesses can cope with that kind of drop in trade. Now, part of the problem is because the art world has traditionally been very resistant to online selling. So it didn't really have a backup option. It very much values one-to-one relationships with people. Again, I'm not now talking at the cheaper end. I'm talking about a young artist in a good commercial gallery. We're talking prices starting, let's say, £10,000 upwards, right? So it's a bit different if you go below that. So they value that. And there was always a feeling that work didn't look very good online. I mean, you know, the surface of the work is important, how big it is, that kind of thing. Well, they had to change their tune very, very quickly. People who'd invested early, some of the big galleries and some of the auction houses have been experimenting with online before now. Those that invested early quickly had to change tack, and everybody else has been scrambling to catch up. I also think they've been doing a lot of quite traditional things, which is picking up the phone and talking to their clients. So the end result, it looks like, it's always hard to say because there's no like one central source of information, but there's a company called Arts Economics, and they do a survey, used to be once a year for Art Basel. Because of this situation, they've been doing it twice a year. And that's it's called the Art Market Report. You can look it online. It's published by Art Basel, and it's done by somebody I know very well, Claire McAndrew. And she thinks now that probably the result has been between a 20 and 30% drop overall. So people did manage to pull things back, as I say, by contacting clients and online selling. But it's been very tough. And I think people were very nervous the very first few art fairs this year. The first ones were the Armory in New York in September and Art Basel in September. I couldn't go to New York because we can't fly into New York. I did go to Art Basel. And as I say, I think people were very nervous.
Does it seem to have hit the newer, younger artists disproportionately? Because if I think of, say, some of the more established artists, you don't necessarily need to go and see another dot painting to know that you want another dot painting on your wall, whereas a younger one who's still establishing themselves needs to get out in front of the collectors.
And I think that's definitely been a factor. So the galleries with the biggest brand names, so the Gagosian, Hauser & Wirth, galleries like that, the auction houses that everyone has heard of, Sotheby's and Christie's, maybe Phillips, but certainly Sotheby's and Christie's, the brands that everybody's heard of were already positioned better to cope with this. And that's also true, of course, for big name artists. I mean, most people have heard of Damien Hirst, even if they don't know everything about him. And so artists like that with those big, or Jeff Koons, so artists with those big, very recognisable names, and also who make very recognisable work, were inevitably buffered, I think, better than anybody else. Having said that, and we might come on to that when we're talking about Frieze, what's been very interesting is that the fashion at the moment is very much towards the young artists. But we didn't know that during the lockdown. I think, though, to some extent, it's depended on how good a gallery's relationships are with its clients. I think the ones that have very good relationships close to them coped better, because I think there was an element of collectors wanting to support the galleries too. The art world buying at the sort of level we're talking about isn't really very big. There's a lot of debate about how many art collectors there might be in the world, and some people say as many as 500,000, but that would be sort of including everything. At this kind of very high level, we're probably really talking about quite a small circle of people. I mean, it's somewhere between 10 and 30,000 people, maybe. And at the very, very top level, you know, the sort of people who do spend millions, it's a very small group of people. So if galleries and auction houses were able to stay in touch with those clients, they've done okay. And as I say, the ones who've managed to pivot to digital have also done okay. I mean, I think generally, people are now saying that perhaps the art market didn't do that badly. You know, a 20% drop in sales isn't as bad as quite a lot of other sectors. And the mood at the Armory and Basel, despite the fact that lots of people couldn't come, so New York, it was all New Yorkers, I'm told. And Basel, it was very clearly almost all grand Europeans. Those fairs actually still did very well. And the galleries seemed quite pleased. In fact, they were very pleased and very relieved. And we had some of the same thing in London. London's interesting because it's easier for people to come into London than some places. So we did have Americans now. In fact, we had some very big American collectors here at Frieze. Obviously, Britons and Europeans. People from India, you know, the Indian subcontinent were definitely around. Asian buyers, not so much. It's still very difficult, I think, for some of the Asians to travel. But they were definitely, their art advisors were here, and we can see from the auctions that they were buying remotely. So definitely there's a sense of I think the art world coming back.
It's interesting that you talk about the big buyers who are there, and it just raises so many questions for me as a complete outsider. But then you also mentioned their art advisors. So it seems that, well, art's an asset class, which we're going to come on to, but it seems that it's almost an asset class where the owners get very involved in it. So, for example, I'm sure they don't ring up their brokers and say, I really think we should be buying Big P because of this. They're ringing up their advisors and saying, I've got $500,000 to invest, go and do it for me. Whereas, is it true that in art they're very invested in this, or do they use their advisors who help them?
I think it's both. I think they are very invested as people, a lot of them. They like being part of the art world. They like getting to know the artists. They like getting to know the galleries or the curators. People are very interested in the curators. Those are the non-profit people who mount exhibitions and biennales. They are often seen as being very able to identify trends and, you know, new thinking in the art world. So people like being part of that to start with. But I think it's also true to say art is a very difficult asset class. I think art is generally, it's felt that if you have a very wide portfolio, then art is something interesting to put your money into. But you certainly wouldn't do it as anything like your primary sources of investment. It's also very easy to lose money. And, you know, you see lots of reporting of these incredible price rises. And again, we might talk a bit about that because we've seen some at the auctions last week, which have been timed to coincide with Freeze, post-war and contemporary art auctions. But, you know, spotting those kind of rising artists is very difficult to do. It's really some very inside people that are best at it. And funnily enough, the people who traditionally in the past used to make most money out of art was actually the art dealers. Now, not by buying and selling it, but because they would buy artists they were interested in and keep the work for a very long time. So when Ileana Sonnabend, who's a great American dealer, she was married to Leo Castelli, another great American dealer. When she died, I think her estate was valued at $2 billion. And I mean, it would be even more than that, far more than that now. But because she had bought a lot of conceptual artists who actually were very inexpensive when she bought them, and she represented them. So sometimes she was doing it almost to like give them a meal ticket, you know, and get some art in return. And she hung on to a lot of work because she bought them when the artists were young. She bought some of the best work. And when she died, of course, the value of these works had rocketed because these artists have become part of what in the art world is called the canon in shorthand. Mm-hmm. And the canon is nothing fixed, but it's artists who have gone down in art history. It gets much easier to see who's in it as time passes. So if you buy a lot of what become canonical artists, then you can make a great deal of money. You can also make a great deal of money if you get onto a trend very early, spot it right, and top out or buy out at the right time. So that's what tends to happen with some of these younger artists. It's not actually very good for their careers, I have to say. It might be good for the person who's buying as an investment. So what I'm saying is it's very hard, I think, to make money in the art world. And the people who do are often people who are very personally invested in it. And because they learn a lot and find out a lot, and because they're talking to lots of people, they buy interesting works and they sit on them for a very long time. I mean, we're going to talk about NFTs. Art isn't very fungible. And I'm talking about real world art. It's very difficult to buy and sell it. It's much more difficult than property, and property is not easy. I think this is one of your areas of expertise. So I used to say to people that art is a little bit perhaps like buying in Knightsbridge. You know, if you buy a blue chip artist, let's say the Knightsbridge property, and you hold it for long enough and the artist is dead, so the supply is finished, and the artist is already well known. So let's say a Picasso would be a very obvious example of this. If you buy a very good example and sit on it long enough, you probably will make money out of it. But that means you do need to be able to afford to sit on for something for maybe 30 or 40 years. You could easily lose money if you buy a Picasso at the top of a particular market wave, and then you need to sell 5 years later. And that's even Picasso. And once you get into the realms of people who are living, it gets much more difficult.
It must be terrible for artists to think that their value is when they're dead.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, this is quite an interesting thing that, in fact, artists are most valuable. It does go up and down. There's a kind of roller coaster of who's in fashion, who's out of fashion. There are artists who were very successful in the 2000s that are not so fashionable now. Maybe their markets will come back. A lot of artists find all this, I suppose, a bit grim. So a lot of artists basically try to, if they can, keep out of this, keep working, and they let their galleries deal with this. And of course, you know, everyone likes to know that they're worth a lot of money, I suppose. But a lot of them do try to keep out of this because it is quite a fickle. It's quite a fickle and fashion driven world, actually.
It appears to be so. And with so few people buying at the top, it's even more so. And they're so driven by these trends and trying to pick the next big trend. I guess my only other observation, because there are so few of these really big buyers right at the top who are paying these tens of millions, is it almost a case that they're supporting each other's buying because they're all just buying off each other? So it is supporting it.
Yeah, there's often been a suspicion of even worse, something called ring bidding, where people who own artists in the same at auction try to use the auction to drive up the price, or at the very least to make sure the price doesn't fall. I mean, I think it's probably more accurately so the price of their artists don't fall. But again, we are talking now, as I say, about it's a very niche at the top, and this is where we're often talking about what's called blue chip artists. These are often dead. So that is the Mark Rothkos and the Rauschenbergs and the Warhols, people who are absolutely certainly in the art canon and where the supply is ended. And catalogue raisonné is as complete a catalogue as can be made about an artist's work. The catalogue raisonné has been written. Then always slight works in progress because works appear that people didn't know about, or there's missing works that they know the artist made, but they don't know where it is. But in general, with those kind of artists, you know what they produced. They're definitely in their art history. They're in the great museums, because that's the other thing. With these kind of artists, over time, as people either give them while they're living or they leave them as legacies, there's a steady kind of movement of these very top artists into museum collections. Museums generally don't sell. So again, the supply is actually getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And that's why you see these really stratospheric prices. That's the sort of blue chip area. And that, I would say, is our Kensington or Knightsbridge property. You know, unless something extraordinary happens, people are always going to want to live in those areas of London. I think the other area, though, where we've seen some crazy, to my mind, prices are when you see, you know, something like the Beeple NFT, you know, where something goes for tens of millions of dollars from somebody that the art world never really heard of. Or you see a young artist, and again, we've seen, you know, examples of this last week, who, you know, 2 or 3 years ago was selling for £15,000, which is, say, it's a very standard sort of price for a youngish artist who's making painting. And suddenly we're seeing prices that are 10 times that, you know, or even 100 times that in one case. Mm. So and what causes that to happen is quite sort of surprise. Well, it's very hard to know what makes that happen. But basically, the word goes round and there are too many people wanting in a waiting list to buy this artist's work. And somebody will sell something at auction and there's a sudden feeding frenzy. But whether those artists will stay at that price level is very debatable.
So it's up to the auction houses and the managers of these particular, or the representatives, sorry, I haven't got the right terminology there, of these artists to ensure that the drip of their art is managed very much so, in so that it's economics, isn't it? Supply and demand. They have to manage that flow of art.
There's two quite different prices. I mean, I say there's two different things going on. The auction houses want to get the highest price for whoever consigned the work, so they're not interested in the artist's career or anything like that. They want to get the best price. They might consider how many works by a certain artist they put in a particular auction. They're going to make judgments about how many buyers they think there are for things, but they're really interested in the consigners. So that's their main, that's who they're working for, is the consigner. Yeah. A gallery, if they are the gallery's representative, that means they're effectively like their agent. They're managing the artist's career. They usually don't like to see this kind of feeding frenzy around a young artist. They would generally much rather rise prices steadily and keep them steadily rising over many, many, many years, so that people feel like the artist is, you know, a good buy. But as you hinted at earlier, the people who are buying from a gallery probably get to know the artist. You know, even if you're spending £15,000, which is, say, is a lot of money, obviously, you'll probably get to know the artist. So people like that often start to see themselves a bit more like the artist supporter or even patron. Yeah, patron. And in some cases, collectors absolutely are patrons of the artists in question. So as I say, there's a lot more, it's not just a normal investment. Do you know what I mean? People are very, people particularly in the gallery side tend to be quite tied up with the people who run the gallery and the artist and the curators who show them, and the fact they're going to have a museum show somewhere, you know, maybe they'll fly to go and see the exhibition. They'll probably lend works to the exhibition. That's generally been the standard view of collectors. What I would say is the internet is changing that to some extent. And one of the things we're certainly seeing is younger buyers, quite a lot of them currently seem to be in Asia, but anecdotally, who are definitely trading art more like an investment. But as I say, it's a risky game. It's a very, very risky game to play. And I think the Meta governor who bought the Beeple actually said that buying an NFT, an art NFT, was like even riskier than buying cryptocurrencies. And I think on that point, he was right.
You've mentioned that a lot of art has fetched some quite high prices. So what sort of trends are happening, and what's the art that is fetching these high prices? What's driving that?
Okay, so I think different things. As I say, the very well-known names, the very established names, you know, people like the Gerhard Richters, they all sold well, and they sold, I'm talking now about auction, they sold well, they sold, you know, on or in, you know, at the top of their estimates. So those sort of artists have got a very solid, very long market. And I think nobody reported very much about that because it was very much business as usual. Mm. They're very well known, they're still living, but they're in their 80s now. And good examples of their work will find homes. I think what was interesting was we had, the auction houses were definitely trying to drum up some sort of excitement and sense of event. So Sotheby's had this shredded Banksy, which they were reselling. And that was kind of the big thing that they were getting some sort of hype around. And Christie's decided to go with an NFT. Again, they don't really sell very many NFTs, by the way. The auction houses are just using some of these to make a big sort of media kerfuffle and sense of event around the event. So basically they had one by, I think it's called Bored Ape Yacht Club. I mean, I'm having to learn about this sort of quite quickly. They're basically cartoon apes. So at Sotheby's, the shredded Banksy, that sold in exactly the same auction room in 2018 for £1 million. This is the first real life auction that's happened, the one that happened last week in Sotheby's. So they got some sort of fuss around this, but you know, it went for an amazing amount of money. I mean, it was hammered at 17 million or 18.5 when you've paid the auction house fees. So that really, I mean, that to me is one of those, it's one of these trophies where it's famous enough, there are enough people who want to buy it, and they really don't care what the kind of art world validation of that is, and it doesn't matter, you know, because it has enough people who want to buy it.
And remind us about the shredded, I know about this one because I remember reading about it, but just remind us what happened with that Banksy.
Okay,
the
so
first
the Banksy,
auction.
So the work was in a frame, and as the hammer came down, the work slid halfway down And basically it shredded as it came through the bottom of the frame, and it stopped just as about half of it had been done. And the auction house claimed not to know anything about this. It caused an absolute sort of media storm. And we all know, you know, Banksy is a massive prankster. There's been questions about how much he even likes his work being sold. I mean, he's made a lot of statements at times about not wanting to sell his work. That's why he makes it outside. And then people chip them off the wall and sell them.
Yeah.
So basically, it was a huge media event, and Sotheby's got another huge media event out of it last week.
And so the one that they've sold now for 17 million or thereabouts, it's the exact same one. So it's half shredded.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's exactly the same picture. They have renamed it, and they are just saying it's a new work in the sense that it was created on that event on 2018. So there's been a bit of a debate about that, because I think it had an original date of 2006 on it, which has been questioned. So they did very well with that. Christie's decided to go with an NFT, as I say, which is a Bored Ape Yacht Club, which is like cartoon apes. It reminded me a bit of the sort of Gorillaz album covers.
Yes.
And again, those were made, minted, I think is the correct term, in September, and they sold for £1 million. So again, there was some media interest around that. I think the real story for me of both auctions and Phillips was this sort of remarkable rise in prices for certain kinds of young artists. And it seemed to be sort of largely two groups. One group is young women making abstract painting. Now, people have always made abstract painting, well, at least since the, you know, since the beginning of the 20th century. But it goes in and out of critical acclaim. And I would say that it hasn't had a lot of critical acclaim until quite recently. There's a big show on at the Hayward called Mixing It Up, and there have been some shows elsewhere in the museum world. But basically, so one of them, Flora Yukunovic, I think she actually only left art school in 2017. She would typically, as I say, 2 or 3 years ago, was selling for about £15,000. So one painting by Flora Yukunovic, she's a very sort of expressive painter. Her work looks a bit like Tiepolo, but also a bit like a woman from a slightly older generation called Cecily Brown, who also sold for a very large amount of money at Sotheby's. So one of the Flora Yukunovic's sold for £2.3 million, which is sort of remarkable for an artist that young. There's another young woman called Jade Fadujutimi. She's in the Hayward show, and one of hers sold for over £800,000. Now, again, this is way beyond what you would expect for artists at this early stage of their careers. And we saw the same pattern across all three auctions, Sotheby's, Christie's and Phillips. And actually, the same trend was visible at Frieze. Now, at Frieze, they're paying the gallery price. So it will be a lot lower generally, not always, but at Frieze, the galleries will be operating waiting lists. So they will be trying to place these very hot artists into either collections, certain kinds of collections, or into museums. That's what they're going to try and do. So they're thinking more about the long-term future of the artist. So, and again, because there is so much pent-up demand for these young abstract painters, if somebody puts it into auction, there's clearly enough people ready to drive those prices up to that stratospheric level. As I say, I think the galleries that represent these artists are probably not very pleased about this, to be truthful. But there we go. that's the market. So that's one trend. Young abstract painters. Another one, we're still seeing a lot of figurative painting and portraiture, usually by artists who aren't white. And this is people who are very much interested in identity and almost, again, correcting the canon. So, for hundreds of years, we've seen lots of paintings of naked white women and lots of portraits of wealthy white dignitaries, let's say. So if you think of Rembrandt, that's what you're looking at. So there's a lot of younger artists at the moment, again, say who African-American artists, Black British artists, African artists, also Asian, who are painting portraits of themselves or their friends, or what's often called genre paintings, which basically means people inside, you know, inside a domestic environment. And those are doing very, very well indeed. Again, the museums are buying them as well as collectors. So that was another very noticeable trend that's still in operation.
Yeah, I cannot remember ever seeing a Black female form.
Yeah,
ever.
They do exist, but they're thin and far. They're thin. It's few and far between. And I think, again, with museums, these paintings were often in storage, and you know, may not have been considered part of the main display. So museums are busy, it has to be said, relooking at what they have in their stores and trying to tell a more diverse story where they can. And I mean, obviously by the nature of who the painters were, but even more who the buyers were, you tend to find, as I say, that people are mostly commissioning portraits of themselves and their families. And it tends to be royalty, aristocracy, or, you know, or military heroes or whoever, the sort of people that would commission those kind of portraits. But museums are going through their collections and looking at what they've got. And they're also buying a lot of new things. And it's very much, you know, this is something very much of our time, where people are looking to diversify the collection, to be more representative, and to acknowledge now that there are a lot of artists working today, but there also were artists in the past. So there is still a process, I would say, going on of mining the history of the 20th century, looking for more women artists, looking for more artists of colour who usually were successful in their own lifetime or in their own area, their own region, but didn't get any wider international acclaim. So that's very much a trend that's still in evidence.
That's a fascinating area of art, isn't it? Looking back through archives, and I guess that's a matter of going to smaller local galleries and seeing who they represented, because if you were looking back at that time, these artists are no longer alive. So it is about contacting perhaps their families and seeing what art they still hold.
There was a very interesting show at the Tate a few years ago, which some of your listeners might remember, called Soul of a Nation. And that was very much looking at largely African-American artists who were working in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Now, some of those artists are still alive, and I think it's probably been quite nice for them that they've had a sudden, at the very end of their career, sudden recognition, and museum shows and commercial gallery shows and high prices and lots of articles written about them, let's say right at the very end of their careers. Some unfortunately had passed away already, but I spoke to one of the curators of that show, and it was quite a task for him. The galleries that had represented them back in the 70s and 80s were pretty much all out of business. It's always been difficult, I should say, to run a gallery. And it was definitely difficult in the 70s. And it was difficult in the 70s in New York. And it was difficult if you were representing women artists or African-American artists. So he had to do, and the group had to do, as you say, an awful lot of legwork. And he told me that they did end up, in some cases, tracking down people's relatives who had kept some of the works, like rolled up, you know, just rolled up in an attic, because that's obviously the easiest way to store them. Unfortunately, and some people had thrown a lot away, but mostly they did manage to sort of piece things together. Some of the artists had very loyal collectors who had kept the works and were still showing them in their houses and so forth. So yeah, it was kind of a big piece of like a big detective puzzle to put that show together.
And this is one of the challenges that the art world has had, is that diversity and inclusion. And even so we've got the minorities as far as the artists, but also the general public and the diversity within the general public who will appreciate the art. For me, it's something I've always found really intimidating. I love going to, say, the Tate Modern, and having a look at the various art, but I'm unsure what I'm supposed to do when I'm in there, and I'm really unsure as to how to best appreciate this art and form an opinion on what I like and don't like. It's very uninformed. So what do you think that the art world has been doing very well over the last couple of decades to make the art world more inclusive, not just for the artists that they represent and the types of pictures that they sell, but also to make it more accessible to more people?
I think that they are forcing, they have been forced, I think, and actually Black Lives Matter really was a wake-up call. I think they felt they had been doing quite a good job. And I would certainly say that museums like the Tate have put more effort into diversity and outreach and explanation than quite a lot of other museums. But I think they've come to realise quite how far they have to go. I mean, I think that obviously there's the issue of diversity and gender representation as well, which the Tate has done, the Tate particularly has done a lot on. So has the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Some of these very, very big institutions, in fact, have, probably because they have very wealthy patrons, they don't have much government subsidy relatively, but they do have a lot of wealthy patrons and artists who are willing to donate works. They've done more in terms of their collection, but I think they've realised how far they have to go in terms of their staff and also the public. And I think one of the big challenges, I think, for museums and actually for the whole art world is that people don't want to explain everything, I think. I think sometimes they feel it's disrespectful for the artist and that it's imposing a kind of reading of the artist's work. But they go so far with that, that either language is so obscure or you don't get very much help. And they're often very nervous to say things like, this is an African, let's say an African-American artist, or this is a Black British artist. Some artists don't like to be put into those sort of pigeonholes, and I can understand that. But I still think that museums have got a lot further to go in how they explain who the artist is and how they help you to start to read the works of art. If you happen to go on a curator's tour, now, the press, we're very lucky. We get to do this every time a big show opens, in fact, even a small show opens, there's very usually a curator's tour, and it's just for the media. And for the media, they manage to explain things, in my view, in pretty plain language. Now, okay, we're more used to reading some of the materials and understanding like what things are code for, or we understand if something says it's Baroque, we know what they mean. But I do think museums have got to go a lot further in helping the public to at least get the kind of basic building blocks of what they're looking at. And I think they've realised that they've got a long way to go. And I think that was a bit of a shock, actually, because most museums would say that they have been working on opening up since the 70s.
Yeah, and they have. They really have. And back when I think art was seen as far too highbrow, and when I was, and also too abstract. I think the whole Pollock movement, when everyone was saying, well, I could have done that. People didn't quite understand that the whole thing is, well, you didn't, that it was done.
And actually, some of those works technically are very difficult to make. So it's easier, yes, for people who studied painting like me, or, you know, art, who tried to make it. I sometimes think it's easier for us to just actually sometimes just understand not just the conceptual aspects of the work, but how actually difficult some of those works are to make. But I agree with you. I think the trouble is that there is some aspects of art are difficult. Some aspects of art, bit like music, particularly not so much popular music, but more, say, contemporary classical type music. Music, art, poetry, literature, some of these things you do have to do some work on, and that's always going to be the case for it. But I think a lot of art isn't so difficult. You know, a lot of art is not incredibly conceptual and abstract. And I think because we treat these objects in this rather hallowed way, we start like that from the outset, and we don't encourage people to say quite simple but accurate things about the work, you know?
And that's true. It's, these might be very simple pieces that we're looking at, but I find that the language used to describe them is so abstract in itself and flowery that you feel like you're somehow missing something and that you're somehow not grasping what this art is about. And I think that's the difference probably between the curator tours, is they're used to dealing with journalists who just get a press release without any of the flowery, whereas for the general public, we're given the brochure version. Yeah, and I think that's two very different things.
Yeah, and I do think that is a problem. I mean, I would say, I think the Tate's little booklets that it gives out around exhibitions are, I think, quite clear, actually. And I think, I say, some museums have tried quite hard, because if you are a really good writer about art, you should be able to write about quite complicated things in straightforward language that anyone who's interested could hopefully understand.
Moving on now to something that is perhaps difficult to understand, but very, very topical, is NFTs, or non-fungible tokens. That's the word. See, I can't even say them. And they're very topical because, as you say, in Christie's, they sold one for over $1 million just recently. And these digital tokens are just, it's really curious as to how something that is out there in the ether can attract so much money. So can you just take us through what they are and whether they're art, perhaps what the classification of art is, and what your view is of NFTs?
Okay, so I think what's important to say is that artists have been using digital as a medium for a really long time. And you could even say it goes back to Robert Rauschenberg, so very famous artist, started working in the 50s and 60s, very much associated with Jasper Johns. He's seen as a sort of pre-pop art artist. He did a lot of assemblages and collages. He set up something called EAT, which was a sort of experimental unit to try out making works with technology back in the 1960s. And artists have been using digital, as I say, for a long time. And there are some very successful artists in what I call the mainstream art world. I'm thinking of somebody like John Raffman, who uses computer games and video, but yeah, computer games, I would say, is really at the kind of heart of the work he does, computer games and VR. Who's, you know, he's probably in his 30s, he's a widely admired American artist. So some of the press coverage would makes it sound like artists don't use digital, and a lot do. But it is true that digital artworks and video artworks and performance artworks have generally been seen as difficult to sell, mostly because most people, when they start collecting, want things to decorate their homes with. That's where most people start, except for our hyper investment type, you know, city banker who's using it as an investment vehicle. But even they probably like to put the art on their walls too. So digital has always been seen as rather difficult to display and difficult to show off, and as having a rather niche audience. And funnily enough, talking about audiences that are seen as quite elite, the people who curate and collect digital art are often seen in a more, I'd say, intellectually elite kind of area, because the work isn't seen as quite so attractive and easy, let's say. So those people are these people aren't this is nothing to do with NFTs, but I'm just saying that's digital artists. There has been a view, I would say coming more from the investment world, that one of the reasons people don't buy digital art is because it's very easily copyable. Now, that actually is quite a questionable thing. I mean, I suspect that a lot of people haven't been buying digital art because it's not seen as attractive as a painting that's on the wall. Nevertheless, so some artists have been bothered about this problem of copying. And I think perhaps one of the examples that might resonate with people is there's an American artist called Matthew Barney. He became very famous in the 90s. He was married for a while to Björk. And he is taken very seriously as a sculptor mostly sculptor and video artist. He's particularly famous for these very long long duration videos, very lush, very, very expensive to produce. And I think when he made the first one of his Cremaster cycle, they made 5 master copies. And to this day, you cannot see the Cremaster cycle online. You can try and you'll find bits and pieces of it. But as far as I'm aware, they have managed to sort of keep a lid on that being copied, because only a few collectors have got them and museums have got them, and they have to be very fussy about when they show it and how they show it and so forth. So I think for very successful artists, the copying problem has indeed been a problem. What's interesting with NFTs, it's basically a way of making an artwork that is original. So even if it's copied, it is not the original artwork, if that makes sense. Because the original artwork is this non-fungible, has this non-fungible token attached to it, and that's registered on the blockchain. So however much you copy the work and say, I've got a copy of it on my computer, I can't say it's the real work. And in that way, it's very much like the difference between having the original painting and having a digital picture of the original painting. It's quite understood that I don't own that original painting. And the technology of the NFT essentially allows artists to say that there is one unique digital artwork, which only one person can own. So in many ways, it confers authenticity to a digital work that would be enjoyed by an artist who makes unique sculptures or paintings. So that is the kind of, I'd say, the technical aspect of it. And I think that is very interesting to artists. And I think it's very interesting to artists who work in a digital sphere. However, what's actually being traded at the moment doesn't really come out of the art world in quotes, in the sense that I mean the art world in quotes. What I'm trying to say here is, there's a sort of accepted path that artists and the art world goes through. So you go to art school. Now, there are some very famous artists who didn't go to art school. Jasper Johns is arguably one of them. I think he did a very short amount of study courses. Jean-Michel Basquiat is another one. He didn't train at art school. But both of those artists were very close to what is considered the art world as they were developing their careers, by which I mean they were looking at museums and galleries. Their work very clearly references other art historical movements. Jean-Michel Basquiat is sometimes described as a graffiti artist. He never was. Well, he did a bit of tagging. Jean-Michel Basquiat was absolutely thinking about art in the way that the art world understands people thinking about art. And his work is full of references to other earlier artists like Matisse, for example. So there are people who go there. You go through an art school system, you start showing your work, you maybe start getting residencies somewhere because that's a way that you sustain your career. You get a commercial gallery, they represent your work. Museum curators start to get interested in you, or nonprofits, and your work is being shown in these twin environments, the commercial gallery, the nonprofit institution. And if the world at large, first, I guess, a circle of your peers, because it's usually fellow artists first, then dealers and curators, then critics, writers, then journalists, then the wider art viewing public. If that group of people, and collectors obviously, decide your work is interesting, you start to build a career and people are writing about you. And you see all these books and magazines behind me. So magazines like Frieze and Art Forum, will be writing about you. And that's the kind of art world that the art world understands. Mm-hmm. Now, you may say that that's very snobby and elitist, and you have a point. You might say it's very secretive and full of codes and secret knowledge, and you'd have a point. But that's the art world. And that's the art world that, as I say, people like Basquiat belong to, and also all these young artists I'm talking about. That's the world they belong to. Every so often, there's almost like a crossover from another but related creative world. Graffiti art actually is a really good example of it. It happened in New York in a big way in the 1980s. And those artists influenced a lot of artists. And for a while, they were very interesting to the art world. Street art is another one. It's another parallel world. And every so often, there are crossovers and fertilizations. But largely, these worlds have their own systems and their own systems of validation, and they're not the same as the art world systems of validation. I mean, this is my opinion. The art world doesn't like saying what is art and what isn't, and I can understand that. I mean, it's a very, very, very nebulous term. You know, when Duchamp put his urinal into a gallery in 1917 and said it's art, that really opened the question, you know, what is art? Is it art because the artist says it is art? Well, absolutely, from their point of view, it is. Is it art if the wider world says it's art? Well, yes. But so these are art forms, but there's not quite the sort of central art world, if that makes sense.
And there are barriers to entry. There are certain barriers. It's not just me colouring in some things on my wall and calling it art, and therefore it's art to the wider world. There are some certain barriers to that.
Well, I would say if you make art and put it on your wall, it is art. So it is art. Whether it's a work of art that a commercial gallery would want to represent, whether these are works of art that a critic would want to write about, or whether a museum would want to show it, that's the sort of big question. Mm. Now, but the interesting thing that the NFTs bring up, because the NFTs, I think, do come out of their own world. They're very much a kind of pop subculture world. If you look at the works of art, there's definitely, you know, very strong kind of cartoonish references. I mean, Beeple's quite interesting because there's a lot of references in there that we can see. So you can recognize Shrek, and you can recognize that kind of sci-fi world, and you can recognize a bit of Metropolis, you know, Fritz Lang from the end of the turn of the last century. So he, you know, and there's political things in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, a friend of mine said, he's like Hogarth. He's like the Hogarth of now. And she's a really big fan. And she thinks that he may well enter the mainstream art world. And he might, because Banksy has. But some of the other artists are much more to do with sort of pop street culture, I think. And I think their buyers and the people who are buying the work are not coming through this validation system that I've just described. Mm-hmm. But it's always porous. And I think what's interesting at the moment is there is a big debate going on inside the art world about what is art. Again, NFT, I mean, it's not totally public, I would say, but people are questioning things like, why isn't craft art? Perhaps craft is. And yeah. Again, one of the trends we're seeing at the moment is artists who use craft-based practices.
So Grayson Perry.
Absolutely.
These beautiful tapestries. I think they're art, but I can do a tapestry, but I'm not an artist.
But Grayson Perry would be absolutely considered art because of the content of them. You know, they are also a critique on the art world. And I think the fact that he has chosen always to work with materials, I mean, he is quite rightly critical and very thoughtful about the art world. And I think the fact that he's chosen all his life to use materials that were not considered art, like ceramic and tapestry. Mm-hmm. And of course, now everyone's very much like ceramic and tapestry, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But they're still quite concerned about what the intention of the artist was and also what we can take from it. Having said that, we've had outsider artists who absolutely were not making art for the art world, becoming very, very successful and very seriously considered and regarded, and museum shows. And so these are not ever fixed points. Mm-hmm. But I think that's all I would say about for now. Well, for me, that's the thing about the NFTs. They have their own world. They have a lot of people who follow those artists and are really into them. And when one of those artists really resonates, I think you can clearly see these, you know, these high prices. I still think the $69 million for Beeple is extraordinary, but you know, who knows? He may become an iconic figure in the long term. Mm-hmm. In which case, we'll all go, well, maybe not. It was a bargain, but another one might sell for the same price, or it might just be a crazy blip. I do think, however, the idea that artists can now secure some rights to their work, and that more and more young people might be interested, well, it might not just be young people, but people might be more and more interested at looking at art online and finding some experience in that, I mean, to me, I think we're at the very early days of it with digital, because I don't think the experience of looking at art on a computer or on the phone is that great. But who knows where we're going? I mean, you know, if we are getting fully immersible digital experiences at some time, I could see artists loving that and doing interesting things with it.
Yes, and I think what you're saying is important for the democratization of the industry, where it is opening up to more and more people. So perhaps by adding these additional formats as art, it does open it up. Now, what you've made me do is really think about investing in art. And it's something that I've thought about for a long time. And actually, I bought some litho prints from an artist called Tobias Hill, I think. I should know the name. And it's an alphabet, A to Z. And I bought them at a gallery. And so it was my first little foray into buying art. And they're limited as well. And I feel really good about them. Every now and then I've popped onto his website to see what's going on with the prices. They haven't really gone up very much, but I'm still very happy because they look great on my wall. So how do you start collecting art? And how much do you need to spend? Because I think this is the interesting bit, is that for me, I initially thought I'd have to spend six figures, and I was quite happy when I could get in at four figures, and now perhaps five figures. So what do you suggest for someone like me who's wanting to take those first steps, and what should I be looking out for?
Okay, well, the first thing is, I think you do need to trust your own taste to begin with. Now, your taste may well change. I can tell you that my taste has changed radically over the years, although I find that I often then circle back to things I liked a long time ago. So, you know, what seems interesting to you at one period of your life may not seem so interesting at another period of your life, but you may indeed come back to it. So I'm trying to say taste is mutable, and I would just trust yourself on that. So And don't try and like something that you don't like. That sounds ridiculous. But, you know, just because an artist is a lot of money, or just because an artist has a big exhibition, doesn't mean you're necessarily going to like it. So start there. I think the first thing I'd say is trust your instincts at the beginning, but also be aware that you've probably got a lot to learn. And if you're interested in this, the more you find out, the more your taste will change and alter or deepen. You may find that what you liked at the beginning is still what you like, but you're now able to make judgments between artists who make quite similar work, and you might be able to start to appreciate why you find one more interesting than another, and indeed why the museum world or the market finds some work more interesting than another. So what I'd really say is, first thing, you do need to be a bit passionate about it. I would say first thing to do would be give yourself 6 months, and just say for 6 months you're just going to go to as many shows as you can. It can be expensive to buy all the catalogues, so don't do that unless you can afford to. But they're often in the gallery. You can often sit down and have a cup of tea at the end, and there's a catalogue that you can look at. So try and look more. If you go to a gallery exhibition, talk to the gallerist. Now, if you go on the opening night and it's quite busy, and they've only got a bit of time for you, get their card off them, try and see them the next day, or try and see them sometime. A commercial gallery show usually lasts 6 weeks. To just try and talk to people and find out more about the work, I'd suggest you start reading some art magazines. They aren't always the easiest read, but, you know, Frieze is quite a good start. So the more you can just immerse yourself, the quicker you will learn and you will find out from people. So, for example, you mentioned that you bought something that, you know, you said it was alphabets. It was, you know, alphabetic letters. So I'd probably say to you, obviously I can't see them, so I don't know what they look like, but I'd say to you, I think a great place for you to start is to learn about pop art. And I would actually say it judging by what's on your wall behind you. Now, pop art is an incredibly influential movement. I mean, it's Warhol, it's Klaus Oldenburg. There's lots and lots written about it, and you can see how it's influenced generation after generation after generation. So it very much influenced Jeff Koons and then Damien Hirst, but it also has influenced a lot of people that were in Frieze this year. So there was a lot of work that was quite sort of candy coloured, You know, there was one I really liked. It was like a big red lollipop with a stick. And I don't normally go for that look so much, but I really liked it. There was something very vibrant and cheerful about it in what has been a fairly, you know, difficult time, I think, for a lot of people. So I think once you know that what you're currently interested in is probably this kind of art, this kind of conceptual idea, you can start reading out from it. So I think it's a bit like choosing a wine. You know, if you know it's Sauvignon Blanc you like, well, start trying some more Sauvignon Blanc and you'll start to find that you may have been dead lucky and hit something great day one, but you might find something that is more interesting by following that line. Yeah, so I'd say start with what you're interested in and then follow the line out logically. Read more about it, see the galleries that have those kind of artists, find out more. And then little by little, you'll probably find that you look at something completely different and go, ah, oh, now my passion is, I don't know, abstract painting. But I think that's what I'd suggest to people. In terms of budget, I'd actually keep it low at the beginning. I think it is generally true that most collectors tell me that what they bought at the very beginning, they don't always keep. In fact, they quite often don't keep. There are a few people I know who bought something and they've loved it forever and ever, and it's never got, but in general, most collectors say their taste changes quite a lot in the first couple of years. So it's sensible until you're sure, I would say, to keep prices low. Now, again, finding out the price of things used to be really difficult unless you went and asked people. It's easier now. All the art fairs, or most of them, have something called an online viewing room with prices on the works, which has been a revelation to most of us, because I, like you, for years thought that you'd have to start at £10,000-£15,000, and Frieze this year there was lots underneath that. I mean, there was things at £4,000-£5,000, and some of them were really great. I mean, there's the ceramics that I've, you know, definitely been eyeing up. The other thing I would say is galleries often, they probably don't advertise this, but you can often come to a payment arrangement with them, you know, even for small sums of money. I mean, maybe if you did it with the very top galleries, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say that, they might be absolutely fine. But most galleries, absolutely fine to come to a payment agreement with you where you're paying a certain amount a month, or you've got several, you know, several months to pay. So that's worth bearing in mind. But I would say generally set yourself a limit. It's very, very tempting, particularly at the beginning, to get very carried away and see something really expensive and buy it. I think setting yourself, you know, a budget for the year and then saying you're not going to spend more than £5,000 on anything is not a bad way to start, while you get your eye in and get to know people and increase your knowledge. Because once you're starting to buy at the £50,000-£70,000 mark, I think most people don't want, they may not expect to make a lot of money on it, but they don't really want to lose that money, I would say.
No, exactly. It's about holding value. One last question before we wrap up this really intriguing conversation. What about, how important is it to be invested in the story of the artist that you choose to support? Because I really like that idea of becoming a patron of the artists, which is how it was done in years of old, wasn't it, with the great artists and kings and other wealthy individuals?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, again, it depends on your personality, as I say. I sometimes say there's almost, to my mind, like a spectrum of people who collect art. And at one end, you've got a highly financial person. These are the sort of people that are interested in things like fractional ownership, i.e. you don't even own the work, you just own a bit of the work and you're never going to own it. And that really is an investment. Or people who invest in art funds. So that's purely really money. And diversifying the portfolio. And at the other end, you've got people for whom art is almost like a spiritual or religious experience. And I always think of the collectors, the Dumineil family in Houston, who, I mean, they actually commissioned Mark Rothko to create these amazing works of art for a chapel that's now, you can now go and visit it. It's quite an amazing thing. So for them, I would say, and their daughter set up the Deer Foundation, which people might be aware of. If you go to New York, outside New York, there's this amazing place called Deer Beacon, and it's full of these great minimal works in a huge factory space. It's quite incredible. And it is like going into a cathedral devoted to modernism. And it's, yes, it's quite a profound experience. So you have people on that end. I would say, depending on where you are on the spectrum, most people, I think, who buy living artists really are interested in the artist. If they don't like the artist, that's a bit of a downer, really, because it does rather tend to affect how you see the work. You know, if you like the artist and you're interested in them, then you are going to enjoy the experience quite a lot more. But as I say, it's what your personality is like. If that sounds just terrific to you and you just want to buy the work and enjoy it and don't want to go near an artist dinner ever, that's also completely fine. But it is true that I'd say most people who buy art seriously do really get into this. You know, they like knowing the artists. As I say, they like knowing the curators. They, as I say, if the artist has a show, and they may collect several artists. I mean, most people collect work by several artists, but quite often the artists might know each other or the work is complementary to each other. That's quite common, I would say.
Yeah, it's polarizing. Some people will want to, some people will think they just want to stay out of it and just collect it as an asset only. Yeah. So it's very interesting. Jane, what a conversation. Thank you so much for all that you put into this. I know that you prepared very well, and it shows just in the information, and you're incredibly knowledgeable. We didn't even get into fractional ownership, which was something I had thought about, but we'll save that for another day. We could do another whole podcast on other art and specifically around collecting and how to get started. I think that could be very interesting indeed. So thank you very much, Jane, and all the best with all of the shows that are upcoming.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.